Thank you so much for being here and making it a very exciting conference. Let's start. That's the title of my talk with an important question mark. Of course, I won't answer this question or the meaning of life. I mean, it's a hard question, so let's just start. This very beautiful introduction today morning by Horacio. Let's remind ourselves what was told in that talk is that if I'm in 2 plus 1D and if I look at an entanglement for a circle, it has a universal piece gamma, and this gamma decreases under RG. So if I have two phases, say phase 1 and phase 2, if phase 1 is unstable to phase 2, so phase 1 is UV and phase 2 is IR, then gamma 1 is bigger than gamma 2. So this was derived in this paper, this very famous paper, and there are many associated work. So this is called F theorem. And what I'm going to ask in this talk is first I will give a brief introduction to some applications of this F theorem in condensed matter. Then I will quickly move on to question of whether thinking about RG flows is a useful endeavor in a broader class of systems which are not Lorentz invariant. So here this holds only for Lorentz invariant systems, as we know. But most things in condensed matter are not like that. So it's a very basic question. Is thinking about RG flows in a more general setting useful? And if yes, are there interesting examples? So let's first restrict to systems which are Lorentz invariant. But you may ask, okay, most things are in condensed matter are on lattice. So how do you ever use this F theorem? But it turns out in condensed matter you often have emergent Lorentz invariants at low energies. So you have some energy scale, some lattice scale at lattice scale you of course see lattice, but if you go very low energies, it may happen that you get emergent Lorentz invariants. So there are many examples. They are topological phases. Then there are symmetry broken Goldstone mode phases, and there are gapless Dirac fermions like graphene, and also there are gapless Dirac spin liquids. So there's a whole list of, there are many large number of phases where there's an effective Lorentz invariant at low energies. And once you are at this low energy scale, within this low energy subspace, you can have different RG flows, which are connected by a Lorentz invariant path. So that's a question. If there's a Lorentz invariant UV fixed point, UV in quotes, because this is all at low energies, but UV at this, within this low energy subspace, you can define UV and IR, and there's a path which is also Lorentz invariant, then you can use F theorem. So let's consider some examples. So the first example is this question of stability of what are called algebraic spin liquids. So what are these objects? These phases of matter, these algebraic spin liquids, are phases of matter where at a lattice scale, you have spins. That's why this word spin comes. And at very low energies, you get a system which doesn't break any symmetry. So that's why we call it liquid. And it turns out there exists a class of such systems which have effective Lorentz invariants, and the system is gapless. That's when this means algebraic. It has algebraic decay of correlations, so it's a gapless system. And there's a class of these algebraic spin liquids where the low energy effective field theory is actually just QED3, quantum electrodynamics in 2 plus 1D. So they are NF number of fermions coupled to some U1 gauge field. And this number NF is determined purely by the microscopic details of this model. So it's not a tuning parameter. Once you have some lattice model, there's some effective low energy theory, NF is fixed. So these are very interesting phases of matter because they don't break any symmetry even at zero temperature, unlike most things you see around here. So the one very basic question in this field has been how to determine what values of NF is spin liquid stable for. So we know from various works, for example, you can solve this theory at some very large NF and conclude this phase is stable. Similarly, if you set NF to zero, we know this theory is not stable. Uh, because the monopoles in the gauge field proliferate and confine the theory. So at some value of critical NF theory, there is a deconfinement transition, and the question is, what is the critical value of NF above which this deconfined phase, which is this algebraic spin liquid, is stable. So here F theorem is very useful. So I will go very very quickly over the argument, because the most of the talk is about non-relativistic systems. So the basic argument is this: if this phase, which is the algebraic spin liquid, is unstable to something else, by some general argument, which it goes by the name of Waffa-Witten theorems, we know that when this is unstable, you generate Goldstone modes, because there is some global symmetry here which gets spontaneously broken upon instability, and in this gapless phase, in this IR instability, the number of Goldstone modes is NF square. You can just, it's a counting argument, you can just count number of Goldstone modes, because you know the pattern of symmetry breaking. But on the other hand, in this UV fixed point, which is the phase you are interested in, if you look at the entanglement entropy, this gamma is my just a notational thing. Gamma means just F. I'm just calling F as gamma in this equation. So in the F for this QD3 is basically proportional to NF. If NF, so there are corrections which you can calculate. So if this is unstable to this, clearly if F has to decrease under RG, this cannot be true at all NF, because here gamma is proportional to NF, here is NF square. So, and you require from F theorem that this number be bigger than this number. So from that, you see that there's a rough estimate for the critical value of the deconfinement transition, which is 2 times gamma of a free Dirac fermion divided by gamma of a free DL scalar. So it's very interesting that this universal ratio of 2 free theories is somehow related to the deconfinement transition. And this number is roughly 8. And you can actually cook up a very souped-up version of this, which leads to an exact upper bound on this critical value. And you can read in this paper, but this is the basic idea. So this is one application you can apply. This is condensed matter application. So let's look at another application, which is to quantum phase transitions in condensed matter. So here's one example of a quantum phase transition where F theorem gives you some insight, which is a phase transition at zero temperature. So this is temperature. I'm interested in a quantum phase transition, which is phase transition at zero temperature between a phase which has a topological order, which is a code word for a system whose low energy description is a topological quantum field theory, to some phase which is more conventional, say some anti-ferromagnet on some Kogomi lattice, for example. And in fact, we know such phase transitions do exist, both in actual lattice simulations on Kogomi lattice. Also, there have been proposals that even experiments may exist which can access such phase transitions. So the one question is, what is the nature of this phase transition? So I won't tell you what this phase transition is, but I can rule out some very basic guess you might have made. The first guess you will make, at least on a very naive ground, can be ruled out based on F theorem. So what is a naive guess? Suppose you do just Landau theory. You will say, okay, this phase doesn't have any order, and at least locally, and this phase has some local order. So let's do Landau theory, and it has some order parameter, which is just some O3 vector, and you just write down the Landau theory for this. It'll be just the usual O3 nonlinear sigma model. And you start calculating critical exponents and everything that has been done last 40 years. But it turns out this naive guess is incorrect, because F theorem doesn't allow this. And here's a simple argument. So if it was just O3 critical point, you can access it from Gaussian fixed point in the UV. This is what Wilson and Fisher told us. And we know that F or gamma for this exactly, it is 3 times gamma for scalar, which is around 0.18. On the other hand, so this is the RG flow. On the final fixed point of RG flow on one side is a topologically ordered phase, and in a topologically ordered phase, this number is quantized. And the lowest value allowed is actually given by log of square root 2, which is the Laughlin-Mannhaus state. And so I'm giving it the best chance to exist, this RG flow. And even that is not consistent with F theorem, because this is 0.35, starting point was 0.18. So it tells you this O3 transition is actually impossible. And this is actually the heart of this whole field of phase transition beyond Landau-Ginzburg paradigm. And you see the necessity for such phase transitions, which cannot be described by local order parameter, just based on F theorem. So this is just an introduction. So why is it that Lorentz invariant systems have this interesting property that we can do so many things? One very special thing about Lorentz invariant systems is that if you look at an entanglement Hamiltonian, for example, for say half space, it's exactly given by original Hamiltonian up, with some scale factor. So there's a famous well-known result. So this means that the ground state knows about the actual Hamiltonian, which is very unusual. Most systems, you don't expect ground state to knows about to pull out the full Hamiltonian just from the ground state wave function. And so it knows about the low energy effective field theory itself. So if you can do so, that's a funny part. The fact that you are able to determine the RG flow just by looking at entanglement entropy of a circle in a ground state, that tells you that's somehow ground state knows about Lorentz effective field theory, and that's only in Lorentz invariant field theories. So there are two things here. First is that the entanglement Hamiltonian is very local, is fully local. And the second point is that entanglement Hamiltonian is related to actual Hamiltonian. So that's somehow, I believe, ties very well with the fact that F theorem exists. I'm not saying this is the reason F theorem exists, but it's somehow very suggestive that ground state knows about these things. So, and there's a paper by Brian Swingle which discusses the issues with finding some kind of F theorem for non-relative system, and the arguments that it's very hard. Why do you think it's very hard? And so you can look at this paper. But so let me give you the take-home messages from this talk, which are contrary to what I have just said in last slide. There are two points I would like to make. One is that it's still, even if there is nothing exactly like F theorem in non-relativistic systems, even then they are close analogs. If you study RG flow of entanglement, you still have strong severity still exists. You can still derive certain interesting inequalities, and it turned out to be extremely useful in solving some very fundamental questions in quantum stretch field mechanics. So I will show an example where it's a completely non-relativistic system, even at low energies. In fact, it's not even translation invariant, the system I will describe. Even then, if you think about RG flow of entanglement, it turns out to give you some very new insights. And the second point, which I just made, was that the relation between the actual Hamiltonian and the entanglement Hamiltonian relativistic ground states, it turns out there is a very close analog of that in all theories, which are in all systems which are ergodic, which is pretty much most systems. If you look at eigenstates, not in the ground state, but highly excited states. So these are the two main messages. So let's proceed. So the context I will talk about the first part is this field called many-body localization. So the basic ingredient here is some theory where there's a disorder. So there is some electrons hopping on some lattice, and there is some random chemical potential, and then there is some interactions. And it has been argued in this set of papers that such a system exhibits this new phase of matter called many-body localized phase, where up to some energy density, all the eigenstates are localized. So this is a phase diagram. So let's try to understand what is telling you. So the y-axis is energy density, x-axis is disorder. So if you pick just one point on the x-axis and draw a vertical line, that corresponds to one Hamiltonian, because I'm fixing, say, one choice of this random potential. So if I now look at this is the energy density mean, just looking at a spectrum of eigenstates, low-lying eigenstates here are localized, high-lying eigenstates are ergodic. So I will define these things in a minute. But the basic idea is system at low energy density localizes, and at high energy densities delocalizes across this boundary. as you change this energy density while keeping Hamiltonian fixed. And one basic question is, what is the nature of this phase transition? Can I say something about it? Because it's a very interesting transition. In fact, yesterday it was introduced, I think, in a talk by Ashwin. I won't presume you were there, but let's just look at the basic phenomenology here. So I'm just repeating what I just said. So if I look at just do the exact diagonalization system, look at the spectrum, you will find that low-lying states are localized in the following sense, that they follow an area law of entanglement, which is very, very interesting, because generally you expect area law of entanglement only for the ground state, not for finite energy density states. So this is the ground state, it has area law, but even the finite energy density states up to some energy density have area law. And after that you get a volume law of entanglement entropy. So this is my definition of ergodic and localized. In an ergodic phase, entanglement entropy is volume law with a coefficient which is determined by the density of states, so thermal entropy density. So what that means is just counting. So if you are interested in entanglement entropy for this eigenstate, you just count how many neighbors it has, log of that. So log of density of states gives you the entanglement entropy, which is very strange. Somehow a single eigenstate knows about how many neighbors it has because of ergodicity. And in this phase, it's not true. So let's explore the possibility of a continuous phase transition between these two phases. By continuous, I mean there's a phase transition where there's some correlation length which diverges. I'm interested in continuous because continuous transition often implies universality. So when you start thinking about it, the first thing you realize is that here, if I think of the order parameter for this transition as the coefficient of the volume law, in this phase it's zero because it's an area law. So if I divide by L to the power d and take L to infinity, it's zero. Here it's some fixed number thermal entropy density, which is fixed by this best spectrum. So it's an order one number. So it jumps, this coefficient jumps across the transition. So it looks like a first order transition. So then what do you do? You might say, okay, I just don't work on this problem because there's no, it's just first order transition. Let's just do something else. But maybe you don't do that. There's an alternative. So let's think about carefully. Let's go back to thinking about the way you think about flow of RG. Let's say there is a continuous transition. So there is some diverging correlation length. At short distances, less than the, by that I don't mean lattice scale, but much bigger than the lattice scale, but still much, much less than this diverging correlation length, the entanglement entropy will be that of the critical point, because that's a UV fixed point. And in the IR, if I'm approaching the transition from the ergodic side, entanglement entropy is of the ergodic phase, which I just argued is just thermal entropy. So this we already known, what this is. So the UV fixed point, if I sit right at a transition, that's a UV fixed point, and the IR fixed point is your ergodic phase if I'm close to a transition on this side. And this is what I'm interested in. So this is unknown, this is known. So let's see what are the possible behaviors. So short distances, as I said, I don't know the answer, so let me draw all possible answers. Let me just enlist them. One possibility is let's do 1 plus 1D. So the area law in 1 plus 1D is just a constant law, and time entropy does not scale because area is just two points. At short distances, if it's an area law, suppose the critical entanglement is area law, then long distance is already given to you, is thermal entropy. So one possibility is this. Other possibility is maybe it's not area law, but it's some curve which is concave down, and it does this. Other possibility is it's a linear with a slope less than the thermal entropy, and one is more than thermal entropy. That's again linear, but slope is more than that. So these are at least four possibilities, and it turns out you don't have to look at more possibilities. These are pretty much enough, except one, which is the answer. So how do I rule out things? So let's go back to the same idea which Horatio introduced, but I won't of course now use Lorentz invariance because I don't have it. So I will use strong subadditivity. So I take these regions A1 and A2, which are shifted with respect to each other by some length delta L, and I apply strong subadditivity. I get what I get is that D2S over DL square is negative. In fact, very basically similar argument was actually the origin of strong subadditivity, as Horatio told me that this was first people wanted this inequality to hold in some other context, and then they actually said, let's say strong subadditivity is true, and that was the first time strong subadditivity was actually conjectured to get this inequality. But now we know it's true, so it holds. This is true. But here I'm assuming that but it turns out the system I'm interested in is a disordered system. So you can't use this argument. There's something wrong about it, because I'm assuming that S of A1 is same as S of A2 in this argument. So you have to do a slightly more elaborate version of this with disordered averaging. So let's do that. So one can define disordered average entanglement entropy in the following way. So I'm interested in entanglement entropy for a given length L at a given energy density E. So E is the energy density of the eigenstate. And what I do is that I define this sum over eigenstates which are nearby. So this is density of states with energy. This is energy density. This is density of states. I'm interested in the eigenstates in the neighborhood of this particular energy density. So I go there, find all the eigenstates in some small window delta E, do this averaging procedure. I'm just summing all the entropies within this region and dividing by the number of states within that region, and then weighting them by a probability distribution of the disordered D. So D is a disordered configuration. And I just sum, so I first solve the system at a given disordered configuration, get all the eigenstates, do this averaging over nearby energy states, and then do disorder averaging also. So for each and every state here in this sum, you can apply strong subadditivity. So there are many, many inequalities, infinite number of them. Then you can sum them up, and then you find that the disorder average entanglement entropy also satisfies this inequality. So somehow, strong subadditivity still holds after disorder averaging, so which is a good part. If you had instead done, for example, averaging of density matrix, you'll be in trouble, because you will wash out all the physics of localization. So you want to do, this is the right averaging, which is what people use to define this area law and volume law in a disordered system. And we are fortunate that the same quantity happens to follow this inequality, which is good. So,
But because it's a disordered system, it's possible that the transition is triggered by a very rare metallic cluster inside the insulator or cluster. In this case, actually, S itself would not show any critical behavior, but if you look at E to the S, because it actually is, even if you have an exponentially rare cluster,
No. But the question is whether, But I'm just arguing that the entanglement entropy has this. If I just look at entanglement entropy, I want to determine its behavior. So then there is no way out. If that's possibility. I'm saying let's assume that there's a scale at which entanglement entropy crosses over. So that's our assumption. So, or in other words, let me put it in a different way. You might wonder that there may be rare states which can mess up your argument, but it can't happen within this argument, because if you do averaging and you get a volume law, it means not only a typical state, but almost all states have to have volume entanglement entropy to get average volume entanglement entropy. You can't get volume law by for this quantity. If you do e to the power s, obviously you can get something else. But within this, it's so let's rule out possibilities using this argument. So that as I just argued that the second derivative is negative. So this is ruled out, this is ruled out, this is also ruled out. This remains. But this is also ruled out because of positivity of relative entropy. So it turns out there's this quantity called relative entropy. It has some interesting inequality. And it turns out it implies that, and time entropy is always less than thermal entropy. If you remember from Ashwin's talk again, that there was this question whether time entropy can be more than thermal entropy. And you can make it, this argument very formal, that it cannot be because of this inequality. So again, basic inequalities from quantum mechanics imply that this is not true, and as I ruled out other things also. So I've ruled out everything. So okay, what happened? I didn't tell you the answer. Answer is that there's only one possibility remains, that time entropy will be equal to thermal entropy at a transition. So you, if you approach from the ergodic side, you don't see any crossover within this picture. So, and of course, I've assumed that little L over total system size is much, much less than 1. So I'm taking first the thermodynamic limit. So capital L is the total system size is always infinite. And little L, I can vary from now anything much less than correlation length to much bigger than correlation length. So this also resolves the original puzzle that why does the transition look first order in this way? The reason was that these two limits don't commute. So S divided by L, if you take first L to infinity and then take correlation to infinity, this doesn't commute with this other way of doing. So if you make a cut here versus here, you see area law versus volume law if you approach from this transition. So transition can be second order. It's allowed. Nothing is wrong with it. It's just that you didn't think about this possibility. So, and you can generalize this argument to higher dimensions. It's a 1D system. You can do higher dimensional systems. Just have an extra additional dimension, which is L perp to D minus 1. Again, use strong subaddity. You get the same inequality, and critical point is ergodic. So that's the conclusion. It has various consequences. If you look at eigenstate at a critical point, it will satisfy this equation, that is expectation value of local operators equal their thermal average. That's a consequence of this fact that entanglement entropy looks thermal at a critical point. You can also think about quenches. It also has consequences for evolving the system in time. So let me just wrap up this part. Let me quickly, in the next 5 or 6 minutes, tell you about the second question I originally posed, whether there is a relation between entanglement Hamiltonian and the original Hamiltonian. So that was true in the relativistic ground states, but there is an analog of that in actually all systems, if you look at system at finite energy density. And this goes back to the idea of what is called eigenstate thermalization hypothesis. So this is work with Jim Garrison, who's a grad student here at UCSB. And the question we ask is, what information, if I give you a single eigenstate of some quantum system, what information is encoded in that wave function? What can I pull out about the original Hamiltonian? So this is what is called eigenstate thermalization hypothesis, that if I have a single eigenstate and look at the expectation value of some operator, it equals this thermal averaged value. So psi or psi is this. So this is microcanonical or super microcanonical. You're just taking one eigenstate, and it equals canonical average. But I didn't tell you which operators satisfy this. Unless I tell you the set of operators which satisfy this equation, this is meaningless. Not okay. So this is okay. That's too harsh. it's good to know which operators satisfy this. So one counterexample is projection operator. And in the original formulation by Deutsch and Shradnicki, it was assumed that this at least holds for local operators. So if you have some operators defined on some lattice scale, it holds. But the question whether it holds for non-local operators was never addressed. And that's a very key step to answer this original question whether a single eigenstate knows about a Hamiltonian. Because unless you have it satisfied for a certain class of non-local operators, you can't do anything with it, as I will just argue. So first, let's assume that I take a finite subsystem A, which could be very big, but I fix that region. And it doesn't have to be small, lattice scale, or anything. It's some fixed region. And I take a thermodynamic limit for the total system. And let's assume that this equation is satisfied for all operators O within that fixed region A. If this equation holds for all operators, then you can derive a new equation for the reduced density matrix, which is a reduced density matrix for that single eigenstate at temperature beta. So this is a single eigenstate equals the thermal reduced density matrix. So this is the equation. So this is a very, very curious equation. It tells you if I given just one wave function, it knows about the original Hamiltonian. So that's a very, very strange thing. But it seems to be true. That's the main message here. Single eigenstate seems to encode information about the whole Hamiltonian at arbitrary temperatures. So what was the alternate possibility? Suppose it held true only for local operators. Even then, actually, you will recover this equality in the following sense. Suppose I look at the spectrum of reduced density matrix for us for a single eigenstate versus that of spectrum of the thermal density matrix. Take log for convenience, and let's say spectrum of these two objects matches each other only in some tiny window corresponding to the energy density of the original wave function. If this was true, only in this very, very tiny energy window, which is energy density window, which is 1 over square root volume, even then you will satisfy this equality for all local operators. You don't require the spectrum to fully match because of saddle point reasons. So this could be a very weak version of ETH, where you cannot actually pull out, there is no relation between the spectrum of this and this. Even then this holds. This is what you call microcanonical density matrix, if you like. This holds true. But it turns out what we seem to find is much, much more than that. In fact, the whole spectrum matches. So this is a result we find. The same, just don't state it too much. Just the main point is that spectrum matches of the reduced density matrix and of the single eigenstate versus the thermal density matrix. Full spectrum matches. You can also check the eigenvalues and the eigenvectors. So you can take the eigenvector overlap. They're fully basically diagonal. Of this single wave function, this is a thermal. So there are many interesting consequences that you can, using a single eigenstate, you can do thermodynamics. So I give you one eigenstate. You are interested in the specific heat of the system at say at all temperatures, and you can do that by just raising the reduced density matrix for the single eigenstate to various powers and pull out the free energies. So we did that. It works. Also, you can calculate a correlation function of operators at all temperatures using a single eigenstate. Again, we tried it. It seems to work very well. Basically, the idea is you raise the reduced density matrix to some power n for the single eigenstate, calculate that correlation function. So this is interesting correlation function. You always, I mean, when you look at Rainy entropies, you just calculate trace rotary power n. But this is like calculating correlation functions with respect to this Rainy index n. And that pulls out the correlation functions at arbitrary temperature by changing the value of n. So that's pretty crazy at some level, but it seems to be true. But the one very big question is, which systems actually satisfy, which systems are really ergodic? How do you know, if I give you a system, whether it's ergodic or not? So the only known exception to this is many-body localization without fine-tuning. So integrable systems are typically very, very fine-tuned, so I won't put them here on the same footing, but many-body localized systems are not fine-tuned. So this is the elephant in the room, maybe a slightly depressed one. So that's a summary, and strong severity is very useful. Looking at RG flows in non-relative systems again leads to very, very interesting consequences, and a single eigenstate seems to encode the full Hamiltonian at finite energy density. So let's
questions for Tarun? Your fascination.
Could you comment on, so what if the Hamiltonian is undergoing a thermal phase transition as the one that is the last part? So aren't you somehow, I mean, you're somehow analytically continuing, is this similar at all to analytically continuing z of beta, and would you run into a problem if this Hamiltonian is
not to my understanding, because so here's one question. Suppose I give you this object trace over a e to the power minus beta h at some temperature, say beta, which is say above TC, let's say. You can ask the question whether this object knows about the critical, does this reduced density matrix, this thermal reduced density matrix, can you pull out, say, critical exponents? Answer is yes. So that's what Roger did. I mean, Roger Malko. So, for example, you can put, say, beta to be, say, twice the critical temperature and calculate second Rényi entropy. And you can pull out the critical exponents from it because that effectively changes if it's, suppose it is 2 beta, whatever, beta over 2, and then you square it, look at second Rényi entropy. So the question is, so the basic question is whether this is true or not, whether this original inequality. So whether, so this is all good, but the question is whether this equals rho a for a single eigenstate above say TC. I don't see why not. I mean, there's nothing special about that temperature. When again expect that the expectation value of operators matches their thermal value. So that was the only assumption. That's the basic argument. Of course, you have to get rid of cat states and all those things. You have to do carefully. But once you do that, I mean, by applying some small field.
Yeah. So if you consider the system at the critical point between ergodic and the localized,
uh-huh.
It has the same entropy behavior. So it's still true that the you should back out the Hamiltonian from the state. Is there a sense that the error is bigger or something like that?
Yeah, I'm not sure of that, because the question is whether it could be that it doesn't, it only holds for very small regions. It's very local statement up to some, I mean, let me put it this way.
But the Hamiltonian is very local.
Let me put it this way. So the fact that the entanglement entropy equals the thermal entropy, that I think that only implies a slightly weaker relation between reduced density matrix being thermal, only in the local sense, if you try to derive that, try to push it far. Because there could be subtle changes, and then even though the entanglement entropy will be thermal entropy, the trace norm distance between the reduced density matrix of that eigenstate with the thermal may not necessarily be as small, because you can mass it up at bigger length scales.
But that must also mean the entanglement entropy is not exactly the thermal entropy, because there is only one density matrix with that entropy.
No,
and that entropy.
We can go in detail. It's about, I mean, there are two objects. Right? One is e to the power minus beta projected Hamiltonian over z, and then there is this object. And whether you work with this or this is a very, it can lead to subleading terms which are different. So leading term, they will match. Because when you try to prove that the entanglement entropy, that the maximum thermal entropy, maximum entanglement entropy is thermal, that the relative entropy proof, you work with this object. I could not work with this object. I was only able to use this one. But this is not equal to this because of boundary effects. So there could be subtle differences. So I won't commit to this one. I only know for that. Yeah.
So you've said that the transition system should thermalize.
Let me put it this way. I don't want. So I'm, for example, if thermalization time could be very 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 long, I'm not telling you the dynamics. I'm only talking about whether infinite.
Mm-hmm.
I mean. So there are many length scales. One is order L, when system typically, most ergodic systems thermalize. Then there is e to the power L, and then there's e to the power L, which is the Poincaré recurrence time. So it could be that system actually takes e to the power L times to get there because of very, very slow dynamics. But eventually, in a sort of distinction between, for example, if you take a many-body localized space, it perhaps, even if you wait up to Poincaré recurrence time, it never thermalizes. But here I believe if you wait long enough, I mean, because of this argument, you have to, at some point, you will thermalize in the following sense, that the expectation value of local operators will match the time evolved Quint state, right?
But globally, system is not thermal, right? So if you look at it globally, for example, you look at entanglement entropy of the half the system, that's not thermal, right?
We don't know, but I'm saying that how do we know that? No one has solved this problem of. I mean, it's an open question to.
This argument works only for small subsystems.
Yeah, no.
Right?
I'm saying that I assume this, right? So I don't know what happens when L is ordered, say L over 2.
Uh-huh.
But no one knows what happens. I'm saying. How much should we?
Much smaller.
We don't know the. Rate. I mean, it's not like it's some exact answer. It's one RG scheme gives you some answer which is probably correct, maybe, but it's not something which is. It's not like quantum mechanics implies that it has to be non-thermal. So, but let's say it's correct. Let's say it's not thermal at that scale. So, what's the question? I'm not just committing to either. All I'm saying is I know the result in this limit. I don't know what happens in this limit. So that's why I say system is only locally thermal.
I think the first result is not that surprising, because it's like, you know, asking what happens if I put a particle in a critical system. Of course, it would diffuse. It would escape eventually, right?
No. But it's very surprising, because L is much bigger than correlation length. So it's L is order whatever. L is order, say, correlation length, not much bigger. So it's correlation length is diverging, right? So it thermalizes that, in fact, all length scales up to the correlation length, essentially. So that's very. I don't define local by this criteria, because I always take thermodynamic limit anyway. So this is always zero for me. So this not. Even if you take, for example, so let me make a much more general point, in fact. If you take a ergodic phase, you can ask the question: does it thermalize when little L over capital L is order 1? Actually, it's not true. It does not. No, in fact, no system ever thermalizes at this length scale because of conservation laws.
I want to maybe continue this by proposing a different possibility of not raised, which actually is consistent with subadditivity and everything, which is, because you're talking about a disordered system, what happens at the critical point depends on how you do the disorder average. So,
indeed.
For example, if I do the disorder average on e to the s, which is the number of states rather than the entropy, then it could be, for example, that then I take the log of that, then that could behave like a thermal entropy, while if I do the disorder average on S, then that behaves like a first order transition and is not critical.
It's allowed.
And it's still a second order transition, and it has a diverging correlation length, but you have to look at the right average the right quantity in order to see it. And that's a possibility that's not in your scenario.
It's not.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm saying
evidence that maybe this is the possibility that actually.
That'll be very interesting. Yeah, I mean, my assumption was that it's not a first order transition in this quantity. So, and then I'm asking, can it be still second order?
That's right.
Yeah. I'm not saying this is the only.
Last question.
So in your discussion of ETH, you talked about expectation values matching thermal expectation values. And ETH also says off-diagonal matrix elements should be small. Is that relevant to? I mean, how does that fit into your results?
They should be small, but we don't need to use them, because that was just tautology. If that equation holds for all operators in a region A, then there's linear algebra to argue that reducency matrix is thermal. It's possible there exist systems which off-diagonal somehow don't satisfy the original assumption of ETH. So then you can say, okay, there are two classes of thermal states in which off-diagonal elements are large or small, but I'm not even interested in that question. It doesn't enter the discussion of extracting Hamiltonian. In both cases, you'll be able to do the same thing, because we didn't make the assumption. And for this particular system, which we looked at, this particular model, people did check off-rank elements. So it's a well-studied system, this transfer serializing model with sigma z, and they satisfied ETA's assumption that they are goes exponentially with volume, the off-rank elements.
Okay, I think it's time to move on. Let's thank Carl.